You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 18th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from here in Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show, Syrian peace talks may be on the cards in late November. Jane Kinnamont and John Everard explain whether there's progress among the platitudes. Then,
this says more about Saudi Arabia than it does about the United Nations. Yes, the United Nations should represent all areas of the world. Yes, it's important that there is many different views. But let's remember that Saudi Arabia is an undemocratic, theocratic dictatorship.
Saudi Arabia rejects a rotating seat on the UN Security Council. We'll be finding out why. And journalist Eric Schlosser pops by to discuss his new book, Command Control, which recounts America's near-daily history of nuclear catastrophe.
When you think about what a nuclear weapon is, you have to think of it as the most dangerous machine mankind has ever invented. And like all machines mankind invents, they're fallible, because we're fallible. And that means things can go wrong.
All that plus, it's freeze here in London. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to meet the founder of Latitude, a platform for Brazilian art galleries overseas. All that coming up, plus some great music too, and a look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. All to come on Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy hour in prospect then here on Aperitivo. Before we get our teeth sunk into that, let's catch up with the latest news from all around the world with Paul Osborne.
The day after being elected to a seat on the UN Security Council, Saudi Arabia has refused to accept it, accusing the UN of double standards and demanding reforms. The Saudi Foreign Ministry says the Security Council has failed to meet its responsibilities, both in Syria and to the Palestinians. Nadeem Shahadi from the think tank Chatham House says the Saudi government is not the only one frustrated by the UN's approach to Syria.
When it finally came to deal with Syria, the resolution was about chemical weapons, almost endorsing President Assad's presidency for another couple of years. So while he's killing his people.
The UN's peace envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, arrives in Cairo tomorrow at the start of a trip to the region. He's trying to win support for another round of peace talks. Militants have attacked a heavily fortified international compound on the outskirts of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. A car bomb exploded at the gates of the Green Village, which houses diplomats and foreign military contractors. At least five passers-by were killed in the blast. Security guards then exchanged fire with militants before overpowering them. Kenyan officials say bodies retrieved from a shopping mall in Nairobi are those of two of the attackers behind last month's strike on the building. At least 67 people died when militants targeted the shopping centre, sparking a four-day siege. Initially, it was thought as many as 15 gunmen were involved, but subsequent studies of CCTV suggest as few as four may have carried out the attack. The International Criminal Court has said Kenya's president need not attend the whole of his trial on charges of crimes against humanity. Uhuru Kenyatta denies the charges linked to violence after elections 6 years ago, in which more than 1,000 people died. He says attending the trial in The Hague would stop him governing the country. Iranian dissidents have staged a protest outside the US embassy in Berlin, demanding action to help fellow dissidents in a camp in Iraq. Last month, a UN team said it found 52 bodies in a makeshift mortuary at Camp Ashraf. Most had gunshot wounds and some had their hands tied. The Iraqi government wants to shut down the camp. One dissident, Sadegh Sistani, says he will remain on hunger strike until the US acts.
We try to get a result very shortly. We continue our hunger strike. Maybe I will kill. Maybe I will die. This is the one way. We are human. We need the American help our friends in Iraq.
A Libyan military police commander has been shot dead outside his home in Benghazi. He was on his way to Friday prayers when masked gunmen attacked, in the latest in a series of attacks targeting security officials in Libya. Passengers at Italian airports have faced delays and cancellations on a day of strikes and protests against austerity measures. Demonstrators are angry about waves of tax rises and spending cuts imposed at the height of the Eurozone debt crisis. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news, of course, from Paul at the bottom of the hour. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, which means, of course, it's 13:06 in New York City. I'm delighted to say that joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
And alongside Jane is John Everard, a former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. John, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to both of you, indeed. We are going to be topping the agenda today on our programme, talking about Syria, as we have said fairly frequently before, of course. The latest news involves a possible date for peace talks in view, perhaps. Kadri Jamil, Syria's deputy prime minister, said yesterday a peace conference was in the works for, well, towards the end of next month. I guess the starting point for both of you is, you know, how plausible is it, I guess, to have a concrete date at all is good news, progress of sorts. Jane, come to you first of all. What did you make of that, actually getting a date? Is that meaningful progress?
I think it's very simple. The regime is willing to come to the negotiating table because it thinks it's winning. It thinks it's winning militarily. It sees that the West isn't up for doing military action, and it sees the opposition increasingly divided. Meanwhile, the chemical weapons' apparent good behaviour has put it back in the good books of the international community, despite over 100,000 people having been killed. So it makes sense from their point of view. It's a good time. Try and strike a deal. And what they'll be trying to do is make Assad stay in power at least until 2014, when their argument is they will have free and fair elections.
John, do you think that's a good characterisation? Generally speaking, people aren't going to volunteer to come to the table and set dates more meaningfully if they're not in a pretty advantageous position generally.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I agree entirely with what James just said. The regime is on a roll. They're still cock-a-hoop from the failure of the international community to react to the use of chemical weapons. And they want to cash in. It's not in their interest that the violence continues. And if they can secure a peace deal on their terms, then they come out smiling.
So that's, I guess, the position from the regime side. Who's actually going to attend? Let's say these talks, you know, there is progress. We get towards, you know, the latter stages of next month. Who'll be there? Do we even know who it's going to be?
This is a massive problem, the question of opposition representation. There's no clear answer. The Western governments who back the Syrian National Coalition want to have that being the sole representative of the opposition. And they say, fairly enough, if there's a lot of different opposition groups, it will muddy the waters. You're going to get ones that are fake ones that are put there by the regime and so forth. The problem is that the National Coalition, in the eyes of many Syrians, lacks legitimacy. It's criticised for being mostly exiles, spending a lot of time in five-star hotels in Istanbul. Can they really enforce any agreement that they reach?
So what would be the negotiating stance? And again, John, you're sort of nodding. I mean, it is pretty difficult, isn't it? Whoever the rebels put forward or is suggested for them, who comes to the table, are they going to have any aims that are actually achievable at all?
Well, that's an open question. And are they going to be able to agree a set of aims amongst themselves? This is another sort of card that the regime can play. Here's Assad sort of smiling, being, as you say, a good boy of a chemical weapon, and he said he can talk. And everybody, you may not like the Syrian regime, but everybody at least knows what it is and what it stands for. And there is now going to be a period where the rebels simply squabble amongst themselves. It'll be public, it'll be messy, and it will make them all look very silly. And Assad comes out of this looking a smelling of roses.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? I just wonder what else is going on, you know, in Assad's head. Let's say, again, he is at the negotiating table himself. He's still the leader of this embattled country, it's riven with so many divides. What do you think he'll be thinking? You mentioned, Jane, at the top that, you know, it seems to be in a relative position of strength, relatively, for the regime. Would there be any concessions? Would he have perhaps some sort of nominal gestures he could make? I mean, would there be any kind of putative power sharing possible, or is that all just pie in the sky at this point?
He'll need to make some sort of apparent concession. I mean, they have, since the beginning of the uprising, made constitutional changes, for instance, which in practice have been quite meaningless, but they know they need to show something. And it seems that the strategy is to focus on having an election in mid-2014. Now, it is quite possible that they could have an election which will be dodgy, will only take place in parts of the country, and which Assad could conceivably win. We've seen Mugabe just win an election in Zimbabwe. It could be a very similar scenario where those who vote either do support him or they're too intimidated to vote the other way.
Moreover, I mean, I think he's, Jane's right, he's going to have to make some kind of cosmetic concessions just so that to get the deal. But who's actually going to enforce these? Unless there's going to be international boots on the ground in Syria, which I don't think is on the cards right now, all Assad has to do is to make these concessions and wait till the international spotlight moves somewhere else and then quietly reverse them. It wouldn't be the first time he's done that.
So basically, are you suggesting that, you know, if he stays in power one way or the other, these talks could risk just being a completely academic exercise?
I think that's a risk, yes.
Food for thought. One thing that intrigues me about this is when we look at the sort of, I guess, preparations that will go into actually planning an event of this character, you know, talks, as you said, with these disparate groupings. I mean, John, in all your sort of, you know, many years of working in the sort of diplomatic sector, I mean, how do you actually go about making something like this happen, aside from the issues of who should be representing the various sides? What kind of logistics are involved in actually putting a meeting of this character together?
The logistics are extremely complex, particularly here, where, as we've just been saying, you've got a very disparate set of anti-Assad groups, and somebody is going to have to go to each of them and sort of work out what they want and when they're available and where they're prepared to meet. There will be endless arguments over who's present in the negotiating chamber, what the agenda is, how long the sessions are going to be. Are you going to allow outside observers? Are the Russians going to be in the room, for example? They've, of course, be pressing quite hard to have some kind of participation in the process. It's going to be something of a diplomatic nightmare, very labour-intensive and, frankly, very expensive.
Oh, this is sounding more and more problematic with every passing moment. It's interesting you raised the spectre there of Russia, should they have some presence. I mean, Jenny, it is interesting, isn't it, to consider, I guess, the other external parties, the Russians, Iran, for example. I mean, how would you view the role that's to be played then by these other key players in this game? Should these talks actually look like they're going to happen next month? I mean, Iran, for example, what role should they play? The Russians too, they have to be a real serious presence, no?
Well, these are key players in the conflict, and I think the conflict isn't solvable unless you get at least some basic agreement among the international actors to stop fueling the conflict. But it is worrying that increasingly our discussions around Syria internationally have moved away from Syria and Syrians and have become much more about things like US credibility, the role of Russia in the Middle East, and things that don't reflect the interests of the Syrian people either way. There have been a lot.
Is that entirely unhelpful, though, do you think? Or do you need to sort of have a broader grasp of those concepts, those dynamics? It, certainly if we're through our sort of Western intervention, be it diplomatic or otherwise, for it to have any use, we need to understand those dynamics. Now, acknowledge them.
We need to understand this conflict at multiple levels, because it is a multiple level conflict. So you have conflicts now within the opposition. You may have conflicts within the regime that aren't visible to us. You have local, regional, sectarian, ethnic battles. You have the struggle between Iran and Saudi, where there aren't talks going on. Mm-hmm. And you have the competition between the US and Russia, where at least there are some talks and some ideas being shared about where they might find common ground on Syria, for instance, in trying to prevent the collapse of the state.
And I think it's important to point out, too, that dealing with Russia right now is extremely difficult. Russia is, not to put too fine a point on it, completely neurotic. Russia knows that it's a dwindling power. It's losing influence in most theatres. And it's starting to treat Syria as a kind of litmus test of whether it still matters in the world. It's important to remember, too, that, you know, if you try to look at the world from Moscow's perspective, that next month we've got the big meeting coming up, at which it is likely that Ukraine is going to be offered this rather interesting associate membership deal with the European Union, something that Russia has fought against tooth and nail for years. And if Russia, as it sees it, loses Ukraine, it is going to be even more neuralgic to what happens in Syria. So that we've been talking about the difficulties of dealing with the Syrian opposition, and of course dealing with the Syrian regime for that matter. But a step beyond that is dealing with the Assad's main backer. Dealing with Russia right now is very difficult.
Well, John, you're, again, a seasoned veteran. Let's take advantage of your years of experience and knowledge. How do you do it then? I mean, as you said, there's almost a neurosis. We know that dealing with neurotics on a local level can be rather testing. On a state level, it becomes, is it impossible? Or are there ways, do you think, that the West, the other players involved here, can sort of finesse the treatment of Russia, can actually make more progress? Is it about the kind of rhetoric? Is it about grand gesture? Is it about grandstanding? I mean, what are the secrets to cracking that very tough nut?
It is tough. The Western powers have been doing precisely that. They've been trying to finesse their approach to Russia to try to calm these neuroses and try to bring Russia sort of back into the fold, back into the tent, so that you work with Russia rather than against it. And, you know, for a period you have success. And then Russia goes and shoots itself in the foot again. We're still living down this extraordinary episode of arresting the Greenpeace protesters, and, you know, one of them now sort of facing long jail terms. Of course, you know, that infuriates people in the West, and Western leaders, responsive to their electorates, find their room for manoeuvre in dealing with Russia heavily constrained. They are under pressure to criticise Putin over this at the same time as they are under pressure to keep him more or less sweet so that you can deal with Syria. And sometimes you just can't square the circle.
It's a delicate balancing act, certainly. Jane, let's go back. We were talking about the difficulty at the start with selecting the right players on the local level, particularly amongst this very fractured opposition.
Yes. How
do you think they are going to address this problem then? Because clearly every side will have serious issues. You can imagine it will be constant sort of bumps in the road from both sides saying, well, this is non-representative of our views and we don't agree with them. How do you? That's another circle to square.
Yeah.
How are they going to tackle that? Or is that an intractable problem at the outset?
I think something positive that could be done, which probably will be done, will be investing in track two processes that do bring a more diverse range of Syrians, of civil society representatives into discussions to try and put forward ideas. So you do have people that are respected at local levels. You have the leaders of local councils who in the rebel-held areas are often running the schools, running the medical centres and so on. Of course, there's questions about getting them out, in and out and guaranteeing their safety. But in areas that are very far beyond the regime's control, there's ways to do that, to bring them out at least into places like Istanbul and to try and bring people that have got more recent on-the-ground credibility than some of the faces that we see in the opposition coalition.
And what do you think, John, about the willingness perhaps then of some of these, some of the representatives who perhaps aren't based in the country and maybe in exile or senior figures, do you think they'll understand the necessity of involving exactly the kind of people that Jane is describing there? Or will there be, do you think they'll remain I don't know if it's a scepticism or a fear about a loss of power themselves. Will that, do you think, deter them from engaging with exactly that kind of crucial group of the population?
I think it's important not to talk about these people as if they were a monolithic whole. They're not. I mean, they're different factions, different people are going to react differently. Some are going to understand the need for track two. Others will simply try to grab all the power they can at as early stages as possible. I have to say, I mean, I agree with Jane. I think track two discussions are likely to be quite an important part of the process moving forward. My background, as you know, is North Korea. And to add a further gloomy note to this already sort of sad conversation, I'd put out that we've been doing track two with North Korea for 20 years now. The process continues and might well last another 20 years. So, you know, don't expect quick results.
But we shouldn't at the same time despair at the futility of this. You think it's still that experience, for example, with North Korea, it shows it is incremental, even if it's only inching along. It's still something we must remain very committed to.
Yes, there's a joke in diplomacy that processes always have surprise endings. Just when you don't think they'll end, they do. and track two with North Korea, I suspect, will do the same. And yes, absolutely, we have to do these things with Syria. There are innumerable problems, but firstly, we can't just do nothing. That's not an option. Secondly, time and time again, we found that by exploring ideas, solutions sometimes just drop out of the process that you never envisaged and were not actually targeted by the process itself. So it's worth doing, if only for that.
Just finally, on this point, I wondered, you know, you mentioned, John, their sort of left-field solutions. Perhaps, what about China? I mean, is there a role, for instance, for the Chinese to play here? We mentioned the big outside players. China is increasingly interested. Could that be the sort of unexpected left-field solution? Could China get involved in a useful, meaningful way, perhaps, if we went to talks next month?
I think that if China gets involved, we're in deep trouble. That, you know, we will come to look to back on the era of Russian dominance, a kind of golden age of sanity. No, right. I wouldn't want to go down that road, to be honest.
I think if you look at it from China's point of view, what's in it for them? They've stayed away from playing the kind of role the US has in these Middle Eastern conflicts. Look at Israel-Palestine as well. They want to stay friends with everyone in the region, and getting involved in these things makes you enemies.
Well, these are... some gloomy notes just got gloomier here on Aperitivo, I'm afraid, listeners. But fascinating stuff, nonetheless. You're listening to Aperitivo on Monocle 24. I'm with Jane Kinnamont and John Everard. We'll take a quick break after that. We'll ask why one country just turned down the chance to be on the UN Security Council. Stay tuned. We've got more right after this.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
The Weekend Edition is the perfect way to wind down from your working week and prepare for the days ahead. Every Saturday and Sunday, we bring you a mix of new music, global front pages, insightful interviews, and lively guests.
He just gets better and better. He's really terribly good. And so it's absolutely aggravating and brilliant, of course.
There's also the usual eclectic mix of Monocle 24 programming, a look back at a few broadcasting highlights, and a preview of some of the shows to come.
This is a film that took 3 years to make. We travelled to 10 countries. There's over 20 different stories in the film about people interacting in one way or another. The scope of it is pretty massive.
That's The Weekend Edition with me, Georgina Godwin. All day Saturday from 8 a.m. and on Sundays from 1600 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with me in the studio is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and also John Everard, former British Ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. John, you're also the former coordinator of the UN Security Council's panel of experts on sanctions in North Korea, I believe, so you may be particularly well placed to talk on the story we're going to consider next, which has been... well, something of a tale of two halves, to use a footballing cliche, for Saudi Arabian diplomats at the UN, winning a seat on the UN Security Council for the first time in its history, joining Chad, Chile, Lithuania and Nigeria at the top table for the next 2 years, an appointment which I think it was fairly predictably criticised by human rights groups amongst others around the world. But then today, Saudi Arabia rejected its hard-won place, citing, some may say ironically, the body's double standards during recent negotiations over the war in Syria. Why then is Saudi Arabia itself, of course, accused of various human rights indiscretions, taking such a high profile stand in one of the most prominent sort of theatres of international diplomacy? John, if I can start with you, what was your reaction to the events today? I guess, were you completely surprised, or did you think that maybe a reaction like this from the Saudis was perhaps on the cards?
No, I was dismayed and completely surprised. I mean, Saudi Arabia has certain, so we say, colourful idiosyncrasies, but I didn't expect this of them, and this is infantile. You know, the Saudi Arabia has, ever since the conflict started, complained about the way that the international community has handled the Syrian conflict. And now, for the first time, that Saudi itself actually has a chance to do something about it, as opposed to whinge from the sidelines. What's it do? It throws a tantrum and walks off. You know, this is just not what grown-up countries do. And the in Washington, they must be incandescent. The five countries elected to the non-permanent seat of the Security Council will have pleased Washington. I mean, you've got Lithuania, Chile, good, solid, westernized democracies. You've got to be sensible. Chad, I'm not sure which way to go, and Nigeria can't on us play its own furrow, but Nigeria's generally okay. And then Saudi, a good, solid US ally. Now, I don't think anybody really knows yet what happens if a country refuses to take its seat. The custodians of the great leather-bound UN rulebooks will doubtless be thumbing through these to try and find a precedent and a guideline or whatever, you know, as to what to do. But if the election is rerun, then it's unlikely that somebody as pro-Western as Saudi is going to take that slot. Washington's not amused.
Absolutely. We'll talk a bit more about what the reaction might be out of DC in a moment. Jane, what was your initial response as well? Similarly dismayed, or was there any part of you that had sort of feared for this sort of development, perhaps?
I think it is a surprise. It's a change in their strategy. If you look at the period since 9/11, a hallmark of Saudi's foreign policy has been to send a very strong message that it does not want to be seen as a pariah state. It wants to be part of international institutions. It's now in the G20. It's joined the World Trade Organization. They participate in the UN process about the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. All these things. UN double standards criticisms are nothing new. Saudi has often voiced criticisms, particularly over the Israel-Palestine issue. So for this to come now, it is a surprise, and it will be a quite personalised decision coming from somewhere very senior.
Well, we'll mull that over a little further in a second. I want to just play you the thoughts of our own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. This is what he had to say after he landed the decision.
I think this says more about Saudi Arabia than it does about the United Nations. Yes, United Nations should represent all areas of the world. Yes, it's important that there is many different views. But let's remember that Saudi Arabia is an undemocratic, theocratic dictatorship. Its views on democracy, which, you know, we're talking about the UN Security Council, it's 15 nations, they all have a vote, it's a democratic body, are probably not in tune with many others. This sort of criticism of the UN for not doing anything on Syria, it's not the UN. This is Russia. Russia has at every stage blocked any sort of meaningful measures on Syria. Now, Saudi Arabia won't understand this concept, or their leaders won't understand this concept, but there's this thing called debate and democracy. Now, if Saudi Arabia wants something to happen on Syria, the UN Security Council, then it needs to be on the UN Security Council, and maybe the Saudis can come up with a way of convincing Russia to do something about Syria. I'd like to see something proactive from them, rather than just going, oh, yeah, it's a bit rubbish.
So that was Steve Bloomfield's thoughts. John, you're sort of chuckling away there. It's interesting, it comes back again to Russia and their inaction or their intransigence.
Yes. What
do you think? I mean, as I said, we'll consider the Washington response perhaps in a second. What about Russia? It's intriguing, isn't it? What would their reaction to this have been?
They'll be giggling all the way, won't they? I mean, the Saudis off the Security Council, they won't be able to believe their luck. And if the election is rerun, Russia will be lobbying very hard for a country sort of perhaps more closely aligned to it to take the regional place. It's the kind of thing that the Kremlin dreams of.
Jane, I wonder if we look around the region, what do you think some of Saudi's neighbours and I guess other people sort of hovering around the immediate periphery of Syria and the problems there, what will they have made of this? Similarly, dismay? Or do you think that actually the problems are so immediate and the situation's in many cases so dire, I think of humanitarian crises, refugees, that sort of problem, that the machinations of going on at the UN and who's sitting around the table, frankly, they're not that concerned.
Well, you might make many of the same criticisms about the Arab League. They've talked a lot about the situation in Syria. Some Saudi analysts recently wrote that the Arab League should send troops in, but no one expects them to do that because no country is willing to volunteer their troops. So, you know, if you're going to make these criticisms of the UN, you also have to look at the fact that the region doesn't yet have any equivalent of its own to solve regional problems. I suspect that the other Gulf countries will be disappointed, that the other Gulf countries will have hoped that having Saudi at the table would help to represent broader Gulf interests, and now they don't have that opportunity.
Let's turn then back to look at Washington. John mentioned the sense of dismay that he imagines. It's probably incandescence, I think, was the word you used, which is probably accurate. Jane, what do you think we'll see from the Americans, both in terms of their rhetoric about this decision, and obviously as the situation moves, we don't really know exactly how it'll play out because it's not a situation we're perhaps used to tackling. What do you think we'll see from the Americans on this specific question?
I imagine behind the scenes people will be looking to see if this is really a decision that's set in stone or if there is some way of changing it. The Saudis have said they'll sit out until there is Security Council reform. Now, that's a huge can of worms, of course, because there's a whole number of countries very interested in expanding the number of permanent members and so forth. Is there some face-saving way that some minor reform can be found? Could there just be a change in the Saudi decision? I think that's probably where things are going to go.
John, last word to you. Would you sort of go along with that? Any difference? What might we see from DC in a word? Or do you think
I think that firstly, Washington won't put out a public statement, or if it does, it'll be quite bland. What they will do is fly straight into Saudi and say, look, guys, slap, 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 retract now, behave. And Saudi, I mean, it's entirely possible that Saudi will sort of, under that kind of pressure, retract its position, in which case they can put the big leather books of UN rules back in their shelves. And it's possible, in fact, that is what Saudi wanted to do in the first place. Maybe this is just a scream of pain, a gesture. You know, who knows? Maybe they're just going to sort of let the world sweat for a couple of days and then retract. We're about to find out.
Fascinating stuff. But we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. John Everard, a former British ambassador to North Korea, Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Thanks both very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk Brazilian art, uncover America's history of near misses in nuclear terms with the journalist Eric Schlosser, and we'll preview, of course, what's coming up later today on the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Before all of that, though, let's catch up on the world news headlines with Paul Osborne.
Saudi Arabia has refused to accept a seat on the UN Security Council the day after it was elected to it. It's accused the UN of double standards and said it's failed to meet its responsibilities to Syria. Meanwhile, the UN's peace envoy to Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, will arrive in Cairo tomorrow at the start of a trip to the region to try to win support for another round of peace talks. Militants have attacked a heavily fortified international compound on the outskirts of the Afghan capital, Kabul. A car bomb exploded at the gates of the Green Village, which houses diplomats and foreign contractors. At least five passers-by were killed. A Libyan military police commander has been shot dead outside his home in Benghazi. He was on his way to Friday prayers when masked gunmen attacked in the latest of a series of attacks which have targeted security officials. Kenyan officials say that bodies retrieved from a shopping mall in Nairobi are those of two of the attackers behind last month's strike on the building, in which at least 67 people were killed. It sparked a four-day siege after militants targeted the shopping centre. It was initially thought as many as 15 gunmen were involved, but CCTV suggests as few as four may have carried out the attack. And the International Criminal Court has said the Kenyan president need not attend the whole of his trial on charges of crimes against humanity. Uhuru Kenyatta said it would stop him governing the country. He denies charges linked to violence after elections 6 years ago. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. There'll be more news, of course, a full bulletin at the top of the hour. You're listening to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It's freeze in London this week, and one of the countries that's been expanding its influence and its sales in the art world is
Brazil. With the help of Latitude, which is a platform for Brazilian art galleries abroad, 11 Brazilian galleries have been displaying at this year's art fair. At the Monocle Cafe, our Brazilian researcher met up with Ana Letícia Fialho, consultant and research coordinator for Latitude, and Mônica Novais Esmanoto, the manager of the Latitude project. Fernando began by asking Mônica to explain what exactly it is Latitude does.
Latitude is an international promotion project, which is a private-public partnership between the Association of Galleries in Brazil and Apex Brasil, which is an agency that promotes exports of Brazilian products and services. So Latitude is a combination of strategies that come out in the format of a program of activities that we develop to the galleries and with the galleries in order to broaden the Brazilian art market outside Brazil.
Well, before we talk about the reason why you're here in London to show at Frieze, I want to talk to Ana, because there's been a study released about the latest developments of Brazilian contemporary art. So what are the main findings? I was reading a little bit, actually quite positive findings, no?
Yeah, the art market in Brazil is in a very good moment, and it's not only the art market but actually the art system as a whole. So the sectorial study about the contemporary art market is actually part of Latitude's activities, and we have the second edition of the study. So we started actually collecting data in 2011 among the galleries that belong to Latitude. So this survey, the second edition, is related to 47 galleries that work in the primary contemporary art market. And as far as we are monitoring the sector, we can tell that there is a sort of very stable growth since 2010, an average growth of 22% per year, which shows that the market is evolving. And there are many other interesting results. The study is about the way the galleries operate, how international they are, where they are operating in the international market, how they function, how many people they hire. And it's true that in the last years, the galleries, not only the number of galleries expanding, the volume of business is growing, the number of people working in this market is growing, and also the number of artists involved and the number of artists based in Brazil but operating internationally is also growing. So it's a quite positive moment.
Which countries seem to you more interested in Brazilian art? Because you mentioned the UK, Hong Kong in your study. Do you think, is there a particular market that Brazil is doing very well at the moment?
Well, the first market for Brazilian art production is US. That's not new. Secondly, it's the UK. But also we have Switzerland, and we have new territories that shows exactly that maybe the Brazilian art production is conquering new regions. So Asia is, we will start to having this relationship and showcasing there, galleries participating in the Hong Kong Art Fair, but also the Middle East, places in Latin America. So it's, yeah, we are expanding the presence in new territories.
Well, that's good news. That's why you're both here in London as well. So let's talk about a little bit about Frieze this year. So, Mônica, how Brazil is being represented at Frieze this time?
We are very happy, actually, with the number of galleries participating in the London Art Fairs in 2013. It's a record participation, actually. We have total 11 galleries this week in London showing at Frieze Art Fair, Frieze Masters, and Moving Image. Some of them are in London for the first time, so are newcomers, which is very positive as well. And some of them have already consolidated their market and have been coming for the past years, which is very helpful also for the newcomers, because then you enter the market in an easier way because people have been introduced to Brazilian art before, so which makes it much easier for the new galleries. And then we see that inside our group of associated galleries, that the role of the more experienced galleries is different from that
of the newcomers, right? And that makes our work much complex because we have to deal with the different difficulties that galleries have depending on the degree of internationalization that they are at.
Another question I'd like to ask, I mean, even though of course the art market in Brazil is growing and everything, but how do you think the world perceives Brazilian art in general? What do you think, Anna?
Well, I've been studying this subject for many, many years. That was part of my PhD research as well. And there is a tremendous change in the last decade, let's say. Really with in the years 2000, let's say the boundaries of the contemporary art world were much started to change to integrate regions that were not so visible before. But Brazil was one of the countries that people were curious about. That's totally different nowadays when we see like main institutions and state or the MoMA really dedicating solo shows to important Brazilian artists. So this is an unprecedented moment of the, let's say, the art history, the international art history. But it doesn't happen by random. It's really, actually, Brazilian art production was always related to the international scene. Artists were always traveling and connected to what was going on. What now changed more of the order of geopolitics. So Brazil is in another place in the international scene, and so is the art.
That was Monica Navais-Esmanotto and Ana Letizia Fialho with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Up next on Aperitivo, we're going to be talking nukes. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo right here on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Do stay tuned for The Menu, of course, with Marco Sippi at the top of the hour. But you're listening right now to Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. Now, in 1960 in Colorado Springs, the bells, whistles and alarms went off at NORAD, America's Air Defense Command. During the depths of the Cold War, of course, and only a handful of years after the Soviet Union had launched Sputnik into orbit, tensions between the two superpowers were high, to say the least. NORAD's computer system on the day predicted grim news. There was apparently a 99.9% certainty, it said, that Moscow had just launched a full-blown missile attack on the US, with T-minus only a handful of minutes until nuclear Armageddon. Yet, in the immediate panic, it emerged that Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, was actually visiting Manhattan at the time. And of course, the missiles didn't land. They were, in fact, a Greenland-based warning system's erroneous interpretation of the moon rising over Norway. Only one of dozens of similarly terrifying stories recounted in our next guest book, Command Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Incident, and the Illusion of Safety. Eric Schlosser, the book's author, spoke with our producer, Daniel Jacopelli, here at Midori House a little earlier.
So, Eric, in your previous books, you've tackled America's underground economy, America's fast food industry. I hear you're working on a book about the country's prison system.
Yeah.
Why did you find yourself attracted to nuclear weapons as a subject for a book?
Well, the flippant answer would be I'm interested in things that are bad for you. And nuclear weapons are really, really bad for you. But more seriously, all these books are tied together by the fact that they examine powerful bureaucracies and institutions in American society that for too long have operated in secret and that the mainstream media, for one reason or another, doesn't like to cover in a way that I think shows what's really going on. So I was working on the book on prisons, and I put it aside to do this book on nuclear weapons. After I heard the story of this accident in Damascus, Arkansas, I thought I could finish this book fairly quickly, in a couple of years maybe, and it wound up taking 6. And one of the reasons it took so long is I kept on discovering things that I thought were completely mind-blowing that hadn't been written before and were really important for us to know.
And as a journalist, it must have been exceedingly difficult for you to kind of crack this this subject. There's so much secrecy surrounding it. How did you access these documents and get all the kind of the raw materials for the book?
Well, the Air Force was not helpful. And one of the main documents I used to tell the story of this accident in Damascus, Arkansas, involving a powerful nuclear warhead, the Air Force claimed that it no longer had copies of the accident investigation report. And I was able to find that report in a university library in Wichita, Kansas, where it had been donated by a congressman who had been concerned about the Titan II missile involved in this accident. I've subsequently learned there are a few other copies of the report held in different locations, but it's sort of amazing that the Air Force would assert they don't have a copy of this report when it's on one of the most serious nuclear weapons accidents in American history. It was a challenge, but through the Freedom of Information Act, I was able to get all kinds of interesting documents. When I got those documents, I would look in the bibliography, and they would have other documents. So I'd ask for the documents in the bibliography of the earlier documents I got. And I reached out to people who had served in missile crews and bomber crews, who had worked as weapon designers or nuclear weapon repairmen. In one case, I interviewed someone who's profiled in the book, who was a bomb squad technician, whose job at the age of 19 or 20 would be to walk over to a damaged nuclear weapon and defuse it. I mean, these are incredible stories. And one of the themes of the book is just about the extraordinary heroism and courage that occurred during the Cold War that hasn't been acknowledged. There were people who risked their lives and even lost their lives trying to prevent nuclear catastrophes, trying to prevent a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And I try to give some of their people their due in this book.
I think most people reading the book would be astounded to find out the sheer magnitude of near misses and accidents involving nuclear weapons. Is there a tally of the amount that have happened?
The best tally I could get came from a document I got through the Freedom of Information Act. It was a report written by engineers at the Sandia National Laboratory, one of our three weapons labs. And this report listed 1,200 nuclear weapons involved in significant accidents or incidents from 1950 to 1968. So there's still another 24 years or so of the Cold War after that. And I feel pretty confident that I've only scratched the surface and that there were many more incidents and accidents that were never reported. I've done my best to compile them. Everything in the book is based on either documents that I found or interviews. It's all sourced. It's not based on speculation or on unnamed sources. And it's sort of amazing how close we came repeatedly to have our own weapons detonate accidentally on American soil.
Is it your opinion that the most dangerous thing of having nuclear weapons was actually the risk of self-harm rather than a nuclear war with someone like Russia?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. I think the probability was greater that one of our own weapons would detonate and destroy one of our own cities than that we'd have an all-out nuclear war. But there were a few instances during the Cold War where we came remarkably close to an all-out nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Now, I grew up in the Cold War, and when I was growing up, it would have been like unbelievable to suggest that the Soviet Union will vanish from the face of the earth, the Berlin Wall will come down, but there won't be any third world war. There won't be thousands or millions of people killed. In the 1980s, and especially, we lived with a daily thought that there might be a nuclear war any day. And it's amazing that the Cold War ended without thousands or millions of people being killed. But it's also created a sense of complacency about nuclear weapons. Right now, as we speak, there are close to 20,000 nuclear weapons in the world. There are thousands of weapons ready to be used at a moment's notice. And I came to believe, having done this research for 6 years, every one of those weapons is an accident waiting to happen or a potential act of mass murder. And the public's lack of awareness and the incredible secrecy that the government has imposed on our nuclear arsenal only make the situation more dangerous.
You talk about the Damascus incident, which is one of the main central narratives of your book.
Yeah.
Did most of the people in the U.S. and I suppose in Arkansas know that that happened at all when it happened?
It was a big news story in Arkansas for a couple of days. What happened basically was that a workman dropped a tool in a missile silo, pierced the skin of an intercontinental ballistic missile, the biggest missile we ever built, with the most powerful warhead we ever put on a missile. This one warhead in this one silo was 3 times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. And I'm not going to give away what happens at the end. I can tell you the state of Arkansas was not consumed by a firestorm and a nuclear detonation, but it could have been. One of the reasons that we don't know more about this accident is the same reason we don't know more about these other accidents. The United States government was adamant in asserting that there was no possibility in Damascus of the nuclear warhead detonating during the accident. And again through the Cold War, the United States government asserted that there was no possibility of an accidental nuclear detonation. There was no possibility of one of our weapons being stolen. There was no possibility of one of our weapons being used without proper authorization by one of our own military personnel, like in the plot of Failsafe or in the plot of Dr. Strangelove. The reality is those things really could have happened. And it's only since the Cold War has ended and some documents have been released through the Freedom of Information Act that we realize how much closer we came to disaster than the government was willing to admit at the time. So I think, and I argue in the book, the secrecy was much too intense. Within the United States government, there was such compartmentalized secrecy that the people who were handling the nuclear weapons in the Air Force, for example, didn't know what some of the safety problems were with the weapons. And the guys who were designing the nuclear weapons at the weapons labs, who were aware of the safety problems, didn't know how the Air Force personnel were handling the weapons in the field. And that secrecy taken to a very dangerous extent, because I can tell you some of these weapons handlers would have been a lot gentler with these weapons if they had known that in some cases just dropping them could detonate them.
An inter-service rivalry between the Air Force and the Army must have played a tremendous role in this. I mean, the Air Force, I think, doesn't really fare well in the book, does it?
Yeah. There was, I will say this, there was tremendous heroism on behalf of the, by the people who served, by the bomber crews and launch crews and weapon handlers. And I have respect for some of the Air Force officers I write about in the book, like, oddly enough, Curtis LeMay, who was very right-wing, who later became a symbol of everything wrong with the United States. I think that he did everything he could to prevent nuclear weapons accidents and impose strict control on our weapons. But particularly after the Vietnam War, there was a lack of morale in the Air Force, and things became a little bit sloppy. I mean, I write in the book about the high rates of illegal drug use in the American military after the Vietnam War, and it's incredible to think about guys who were handling nuclear weapons smoking pot, using LSD, and yet that's all documented, that was going on. So when you think about what a nuclear weapon is, you have to think of it as the most dangerous machine mankind has ever invented. And like all machines mankind invents, they're fallible, because we're fallible. And that means things can go wrong. But if something goes wrong with a nuclear weapon, it's a lot more serious than if something goes wrong with the microphone in this studio, for example.
That was Eric Schlosser talking to our producer Daniel just a bit earlier. And Eric's book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Incident and the Illusion of Safety, is out now, published by Alan Lane. Time now for a bit of, if you'll forgive us, music with a slightly nuclear theme. There's its ominous sound right now. The 4-minute warning, of course, many people will remember that, the public alert system conceived by the British government during the Cold War. It operated all the way from the 50s. Into the 90s, supposedly deriving from the length of time it would take a Soviet nuclear missile attack to confirm before impact of missiles on targets. In reality, though, it should have actually been 3 minutes or less, because it was quicker. But notwithstanding that, it shouldn't let that stand in the way of playing a good song. So here's Radiohead with 4-minute warning.
This is just a nightmare. Soon I'm gonna wake up.
That was Radiohead with 4-minute warning. You're just about to get your 3-minute warning that the menu is next. That's coming up, of course, at the top of the hour. Before that, though, on Aperitivo, we're going to talk about what's coming up later this evening on the station. I'm joined here in Studio One by not only Barbara Feeney, producer of The Globalist Asia, but also by Daphne Denny, producing The Monocle Daily. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Tom.
Now, where should we start? Let's work chronologically. That makes sense. Barbara, with you first. Globalist Asia, what is in your box of tricks for this evening?
So, Tom, first of all, we are in Japan because Shinzo Abe is introducing this new secrecy law, because there's this kind of tradition of politicians kind of passing on information to journalists. So he's trying to crack down on this.
He is.
Yeah, so...
I bet journalists aren't that happy about it.
No, they wouldn't be, because, where are they going to get their scoop from?
Exactly. Well, we'll be unpicking that story in more detail in The Globalist Asia. Daphne, what about the Monocle Daily? Have you got a box of tricks, or is it...
I'm not sure it's a box of tricks.
Is it a treasure trove?
I think we have. I would definitely describe it as
What is the main delight in your trove, very briefly?
The main delight is an interview by Steve Bloomfield of Ian Martin on the downfall of the Royal Bank of Scotland. It's really interesting. Financial, we hit on bankers, but not too much. But, we just...
Just the right amount.
Yeah,
just the
right, we talk about the financial crisis, basically.
Perfect stuff. So that is the Monocle Daily that Daphne is stewarding. That'll be coming your way at 2200 hours, of course. Globalist Asia at 2200 hours. Not too long to wait from that. Barbara and Daphne, thank you both for stopping by. Sorry that was rather brief, because that is all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My special thanks to our guests, Jane Kinnamont and John Everard. Our show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Alexa Firmanich and Andrea Alacon, and our studio manager was the smooth Chris Chilvers. Next up, we've got the headlines. After that, the menu with Marcus Hippie. We'll be back at the very same time on Monday, 1800 hours, London time, as if you needed reminding. But from this Friday edition of Aperitivo, with me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.